welcome to another edition of the Columbia University Sports Podcast, The Cusp Show. I'm Joe Favorito, who usually does this with my co-host, Tom Richardson, but Tom is off this week doing career education counseling at Columbia. So I'm going to do this one solo. And we've got a special guest today. There are very few people who can talk about pitching, analytics, philosophy, and then come out with a best-selling book that has background information, not just from someone like Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner of the Chicago White Sox, but Steven Soderbergh as well. So Rick Peterson, our guest, covers a tremendous amount of topics, is known best for his work around baseball, but we're going to touch on how he got to where he is and his new book, which is called Crunch Time. Rick, welcome to the podcast.
So, my pleasure, Joe. How are you doing today?
Great. So let's kind of, for those who listen, and our audience, as you probably know, is made up of students, people in the sports business industry, the media industry, the analytics industry. Why don't we talk a little bit about, for a couple of minutes, about your background, Rick, how you kind of got to where you are. Your father, Pete Peterson, was the general manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates when they won the World Series in the late 70s. You had quite a storied career, not as much on the pitching mound, but around the pitching mound, advising some of the greatest baseball teams in the last 30 years, including the Moneyball A's, and helping them build their pitching staff. So why don't you kind of walk us through how you got to where you are today as an author, an advisor, and someone who's really trying to help people kind of grow their businesses.
Yeah, great. I'll be as brief as I can, which is not easy for me, as you know. But I, as you said, I grew up in a baseball family. My dad played in the big leagues for the Pirates. My dad actually played the last game in the Polo Grounds in Ebbets Field as a catcher for the Pirates. And so the whole We Are Family in 1979 concept around the championship Pirates really wasn't around Sister Sledge's song. It really was around the Pirates were a family. And back in those days, every team was a family. You know, it was the Dodger way, the Yankee way, you know, the Pirate way. And so Danny Murtaugh was Uncle Danny growing up, you know, who managed the 1960, 1971 World Championship teams. So I was around, literally, I was around Roberto Clemente and Bill Mazeroski, Willie Stargell, Bill Verdon. I was around all these people as kids. And Danny Murtaugh was Uncle Danny. In fact, I was 12 until I realized my mom said, you know, he's really not your uncle. I said, Mom, geez, come on, you know. I said, but that's how that environment was. So I grew up, and then, you know, I was drafted by the Orioles out of high school and, you know, went to 4 years of college and got drafted multiple times and signed and, you know, hurt my arm my freshman year. So I played 4 years in the minor leagues, but I was hurt from my freshman year all the way through the next 8 years. I pitched 4 years in college, 4 years in the minor leagues. And I got my degree in basically sports psychology, combination of art. And that was really my real interest. And during the time I played, you know, I was always working with other, you know, helping other guys from the mental part of the game, from the, you know, literally the sports psychology behavior, you know, how to compete, how to handle pressure best, how to focus. And they wanted me to get in, Murray Cook, who wanted me to get into coaching, and I really didn't have the interest to get into coaching. And, you know, actually my senior year, I actually took a TM, a Transcendental Meditation class, to help me deal with pressure, you know, on the field as a pitcher. And so I really got into yoga and meditation back in those days and, you know, mindfulness training, and that was my real interest. But I decided I would coach for a couple years and realized, like, you know, geez, I love this. And so I coached for, you know, many years, and probably fast forward, probably the turning point of my career was I left Cleveland and I went to the White Sox in 1989 as a double-A pitching coach. And right before we left spring training, Larry Himes, the GM, called me in the office. Double-A team was in Birmingham. He said, Rick, listen, when you get to Birmingham, Dr. Andrews has opened up the American Sports Medicine Institute lab solely for the study of the biomechanics of the pitching delivery to reduce the risk of injury and to enhance performance. And he had just done Roger Clemens' shoulder, and Dr. Andrews wanted to ask the question, why are these guys getting hurt? And Larry said, you're going to take our pitchers into the lab and get analysis. I was the first uniformed person to ever walk in that lab in 1989, and my whole career totally shifted. I went from a traditional old school baseball thinker from that point to basically New School. And that's really when, and I'm not sure who the author is of the quote, but that's when my whole career shifted from a quote of, "In God we trust, all others must have data." And so that became the foundation of our pitching development program. And it was a struggle for me educationally, because I was more in tune with behavior modification, you know, not biomechanics and kinesiology. You know, and then fast forward after a few years with the White Sox, and, you know, I co-directed the sports psychology program. I was there when Michael Jordan was playing baseball. And I got to know Michael. I was around Michael a lot. In fact, there's a story in our book about Michael and what we all learned from, you know, one of the greatest athletes of all time. You know, arguably, he's in that list of top 10 without question, if not top 5. And then I eventually, you know, left the White Sox and, you know, went to Toronto, and then found myself in 1998 as the pitching coach for the Oakland A's. And then my career totally launched. And, you know, those were the Moneyball days. And we were doing things, you know, Billy was using concepts from Bill James and predictive analysis and so on down the line. And, you know, we were using biomechanics and, you know, looking at data, and we were collecting data, you know, from all kinds of different metrics. And some of the data, we didn't even know why we were collecting it. We were collecting it, and some of it had value, some of it didn't have value. But we stumbled on so many different metrics that related to a process of how you can win a baseball game, from pitching to defense to offense and so on down the line. And then after winning 102 games, Jason Giambi, MVP, free agent, Johnny Damon, all-star center fielder, free agent, Jason Risringhausen, all-star closer, free agent. We lost all three of those guys. And that's what Moneyball, the movie and book, was all about. Michael Lewis came in to write a story for the New Yorker magazine, and after 3 or 4 weeks called his publisher after Liar's Poker and said, "This is a bestseller." And they said, "Go for it." And you talk about a privilege. I sat next to Michael Lewis for 6 months on the bus, going from the airport to the hotel to the ballpark and then back to the airport. And I learned so much. I mean, you're talking about one of the most prolific writers of all time. And, you know, had a chance to really get to know him well. And, you know, obviously he wrote an endorsement on the cover of our book. And then, you know, left and went to New York. And then eventually, after Willie Randolph and I were fired, let go by the Mets in 2008, I was under contract through 2009. And I decided to sit out that year and just kind of go through a whole self-healing process. And that's when really the whole concept of the book started. In February 2009, I get a call from Billy Beane. He said, "Rick," he said, "you're not going to believe this. You're doing a movie on Moneyball. And Brad Pitt's playing yours truly." I said, "Geez, come on, get out of here." He said, "Steven Soderbergh is going to be the director." And I just got off the phone with Steven, and I hope you don't mind. He asked for your phone number. He'd like to talk to you. Well, I was like a right-hand person with Billy Beane, for Billy Beane and Art Howe, and incredibly close with Paul DiBattista, who Jonah Hill played in the movie. And I was the peacekeeper. I was the one that was like trying to handle all that friction between old-school baseball and predictive analysis and analytics and the whole deal. And so the next day I get a call from Steven Soderbergh, and he said, "Rick," he said, "I'm a baseball fanatic first. Pitching's my favorite part of the game, and I'm so intrigued with what you guys have done pitching-wise with analytics and biomechanics, and I can't wait to talk to you about it. But the reason I'm calling, I'd like to offer you the opportunity to be technical director of Moneyball." I said, "I'm all in. Holy cow, I don't know what a technical director does. I'm in. Tell me what I do." And he explained to me the role of a technical director. And by the time we got off the phone, he asked me, "How would you like to play yourself in the movie?" I said, "Geez, I play myself in my own movie. I might as well play myself in yours." His concept of the movie, which never got done, he had over 20 of us going to play ourselves. Art Howe, Hatterberg, Bradford, David Justice, the scouting directing team. And I worked with Steven Soderbergh for 5 months on that movie project. And we would have long talks about how to deal with pressure most effectively, because we all deal with our own personal pressure, whether it's family, financial, career pressure. And I was curious about, as a director, the pressure of being on time, on budget, you know, get these scenes right, you know, the whole editing process. And he would explain to me so much about the pressure from a director and, you know, how to handle all these stars, you know, these big egos. And then he was always asking me, like, you know, what do you say when you go to the mound to talk to a pitcher in front of 50,000 people in a sellout crowd to calm his mind down, and you got literally 30, 45 seconds to a minute? And that's how the concept of this book really started. And it was all about dealing with pressure, and one story would lead to the next. And he said, you got to do a book, Rick. And I said, I'm not doing a book on me, and I'm not doing a book on baseball, but if I can meet the right business writer, I would love to do a book about sports, the business of sports, and how we all deal with those kind of pressures and shifting threats to opportunities. Because people that are incredibly successful, they defeat fear, worry, and doubt by asking, what's the opportunity? And that's really kind of it in a nutshell. And, you know, because of the book and because of the excitement around it and meeting so many people outside of it, and I've done probably 30 keynote addresses over the years, people approach me and I'm starting a new chapter in my life. I'm going to start doing corporate workshops and keynote speaking and basically sharing all the wisdom that we've learned from, you know, my career of being privileged enough to coach Hall of Famers and Cy Young Award winners and being around people like Michael Jordan, and share that through Judd Hoekstra, the co-author, and his experience. He's co-authored books with Ken Blanchard, you know, the revered business writer of probably close to 100 bestsellers, and share that conventional wisdom. And it's, the book is really like a handbook of how to deal with pressure. There's strategies in there of how to deal with pressure and shift it from threat to opportunity.
The book is called Crunch Time. It is written by Judd Hoekstra and our guest, Rick Peterson, known as pitching coach par excellence, recently left the Baltimore Orioles as their director of pitching and is now out kind of telling the stories of what he's experienced, not just from a baseball perspective, but from a business perspective. Rick, one of the questions that a lot of people ask, and, you know, Vince Gennaro, who's the head of Sabre, is the head of the Columbia program, is as you were coming along, how did you balance the analytic side with the on-the-field side? What were the things that you looked for to kind of figure out that balance, and then how did you kind of take that and make it work successfully with athletes who may not have understood what analytics was all about?
Well, I guess the best analogy I could use, Joe, is that you don't need to know how to build a car to learn how to drive one. So when you're learning how to drive one, the driving instructor is teaching you how to drive this car. And so once you get to know every one of the pitchers on your team, and I always use the analogy that you need to speak 12 different languages, and you need to be able to speak to that person for what they can handle. So we would collect all the data and look at all the analytics and then figure out, okay, what's the best way to share this, to lay out a game plan so that the pitcher's mind can become, you know, calm and focused on the process. Because literally the process for the pitcher is to hit the glove, hit the target. Pitchers are, we call them professional glove hitters. You get paid to hit the glove. And pitchers hit the glove well, they happen to do well. So we would look at all the analytics. So, for example, in pitching, again, I'm going to oversimplify this and we can get more complex if you want to go down that path. If the listeners just touch the bottom of their kneecap, that's the bottom of the strike zone, and it's measured by the front of home plate. Every ball put in play or swung at the bottom of the strike zone, in each individual year, over a decade, the batting average is under 200. Under 200. All the odds are in the pitcher's favor. And so we would develop a process. So we literally would put a string up in front of home plate at the height of the bottom of the kneecap so the pitcher can get biofeedback about making sure that you could hit the bottom of the strike zone or get below the bottom of the strike zone. And then with TrackMan data and PitchFX data coming in, you know, you look at Major League Baseball and they call it StatCast. You know, that's TrackMan data. And TrackMan data, there's predictive analysis around TrackMan data. So it's really taking something really complex and then really putting it together like in Cliff Notes, making this as simple as possible. And so all the listeners here that are Met fans, you know, one of the things that media would kill me, like people would ask about biomechanics, and I'd be like, well, you know, when the front foot lands, you know, the bend of the knee needs to be, you know, firm at foot contact, it collapses at ball release, the hip rotation velocities are only 400 degrees per second. And people would say, like, geez, you think Oliver Perez understands that? No. You think I'm talking to Oliver Perez about that? No. You know, by no means. So it depends on what information people could handle. But the bottom line is that we had a process, And if you can execute that process, and that's the one thing I've learned from all the great people I've ever been around that are successful, they formulate a process, and everybody stays focused on the process of performing the process. And if you can execute the process, you know that you'll get the outcomes because the process will lead to the outcomes. And that's what predictive analysis is about.
Who are some of the players that you were around that you were actually surprised were able to buy into the process? Some of them are in the book. What were some of the bigger surprises that you got out of success from athletes who you would looked at and said, man, I didn't think these guys were ever going to get it? Who were some of the success stories?
Well, I would say one of the biggest ones, and he actually talks about it in his Hall of Fame speech, is Tom Glavin. And this story is shared in the book where Tom Glavin – It's now TrackMan data, but initially the first data that came in from Sandy Alderson, overseeing the umpires, was Questec. And basically it's radar is what it is. It's a radar system that measures the ball comes out of the pitcher's hand. It either goes over home plate at the height of the strike zone at the bottom and the top of the strike zone, or it doesn't. It's radar. And the umpires get a report. At the end of every game, the umpire goes on, logs on, and he gets a report to see how well he called the game. You know, if it went over the plate, it's a strike. If it went off the plate, it's a ball. And the umpires that do the postseason, they get the best grades. So when Tommy came over to the Mets, there wasn't a Questec system in Atlanta. There was one in New York. And if you watch a game closely, at the very beginning of the game, oftentimes a ball boy will go put a ball on the pitching rubber and the starting pitcher runs out and picks it up. In New York, when Tom would go out, the umpire would walk up and hand him the ball and look at Tommy and go like, Questec, Tommy, meaning that you got to throw it over home plate. So Tommy won over 260-some games in his career by throwing fastball changeup 6 to 8 inches off the plate, and the umpire would call it a strike if it hit the glove. Well, no longer was that the case. He had to throw it over home plate. So he went through an incredibly rough time when he came to New York, and he was really struggling, and I'll never forget in front of 50,000 people, and if some of the listeners were at this game, I'm pointing the finger, because in front of 50,000 people, he got knocked out in the third inning, and 50,000 people were chanting, Glavin sucks, about as loud as you can hear it. And you talk about, people think that Hall of Famers don't go through fear, worry, and doubt. Don't kid yourself. Everybody does. And he was about as low as it could possibly go. The next day, Jeff Wilpon called me in the office with Willie Randolph and a bunch of other people in the front office. He said, is Tom Glavin done? Is his career over? I said, no, Tom Glavin's career is not over. Questec has killed Tommy's old game. He's got a new game that if he commits to it, Cute said, he'll still be really good. He's probably not going to be as good as what he was when it was 8 inches off the plate and it's a strike, because hitters can't cover 25 inches. So anyway, bottom line, he said, look, you got to get Tommy to commit to this. And I said, okay, this is not that easy. You know, when you're coaching Hall of Fame caliber players, you got to drive around the block a few times before you pull in the driveway. So anyway, Tommy gets knocked out in Seattle, his next start, and we're flying back to New York. And I went to the back of the plane, and I knew I had to talk to him. And he sat in the very end of the last seat. So when I looked at Tommy, his face was in his hands, and he looks up and he's like, Coach, if you got something, he goes, I'm like totally open. And I sat down and I said, Tommy, you know what? You know what's killing you? You're Tom Glavin. Tom Glavin stands for fastball changeup to the plate, and they call it a strike. I said, Questec has killed their game, Tommy. I said, no different in business. The president and CEO of AOL said, we're going to sell internet access. Well, the president of Google came on and said, you know what? We're going to give it away. We'll sell advertising. It killed the whole AOL model. It was a brand new model. And I said, Questec has killed your game, Tommy. And I asked him, I said, who's the most prolific performer in their sport, dominates your sport? He said, Tiger Woods. And at that time, Tiger was Tiger Woods. And Tom had played a round of golf with Tiger. And so he knew a lot about Tiger, met him, had lunch with him. I said, you know what, Tommy? At the beginning of Tiger's run, he won the Masters by 12 strokes. 12 strokes. And on Tuesday, he came out and said, I need a new game. Wow, what's the matter with your old game? And I said, that's where you are at this point in your career, Tommy. I said, if you had five starts to turn this around, and if not, you had to go back to the minor leagues, would you keep doing what you're doing? He said, no, absolutely not. I said, well, give us five starts to lay out a game plan. We'll lay out a game plan with predictive analysis, with data, and if you execute that game, then if this fails in five starts, I'll go back to the minor leagues. And he goes, I'm all in, coach. And that was the time that Tommy had to make a change. He was forced to. And I look at Tom Glavine with the courage that he had, you know, to literally commit to doing something totally different than what he'd ever done for 16 plus 17 years of his career, to a whole brand new process. But fear, worry, and doubt had totally cracked his whole confidence. He no longer looked at himself as a Hall of Famer. You know, he was looking at himself as someone who's really struggling at the back end of his career. And that's a commitment to making a change and understanding that what's the opportunity here. And I said, the opportunity is we need to make a change, Tommy, and you have to have the courage to do this. And he went on to make the All-Star team that year and the year after. But that's a real testimony to someone who's got that kind of courage. But that's what happens in business every day. You know, you can't keep doing the same thing and having the same success.
How for most of the people who will listen to this will not be Major League Baseball players or not be Michael Jordan, although they may be. You never know. How do some of the factors in the book and the stories that you tell in the book, which are great, translate over to a student, a teacher, a business person? What are the kind of the basic pieces, Rick, that are laid out in crunch time that translate from the mound to the boardroom?
Well, when you say the boardroom, let's go back to the students. I mean, so all the students here that are studying at Columbia, you know, they're coming in and you come into this major exam, you got your final, and the final is going to determine your final grade. Well, fear, you're saturated with fear, worry, and doubt at that time. But so fear, worry, and doubt stands on four legs. Stands on a lack of preparation, a lack of knowledge, a lack of insight, and a lack of talent. So if we recognize the fact that I'm feeling this fear, worry, and doubt, and it's overwhelming me, you ask yourself, am I prepared for this exam? Do I have the talent and the confidence in my talent that I'm ready for this exam? Do I have the knowledge? Have I studied for this? And do I have the insight to sometimes in the midst of the test, you know, take a deep breath, relax, you know, you start, you know, you're looking at the clock, I got 10 minutes left, and, you know, you got to calm down a little bit and get your mind calm and focus, you know, so, and it's the same thing in the boardroom. It's the same thing in the big sales presentation. It's the same thing in the sales cycle. When it comes down to that final, you know, that final, like, stretch, that final moment, you have to stay calm and focused. And then probably the best example of all, you know, most recently is the Super Bowl. I mean, here's Tom Terrific down by 25 points. And you look at you when the camera was on his face down by 25 points on third and whatever five, that face was calm and focused on the process of this play. And Bill Belichick and what Tom Brady have done, you know, whether you're a fan or not, you know, is another issue, but that's a testimony to crunch time and how to deal with crunch time and have the confidence in your process and your preparation and your knowledge and your talent to just say, look, just take it. It's one play at a time. It's one question at a time. It's one sales call at a time. And one of the things I think that was really, really most revealing, the co-author Judd, when we were going through this content and it had to do with this whole process with the pitcher of hit the glove, just focus on hit the glove. And so Judd and I would have long talks, and he said, you know, I have to identify for my sales team, because he's the national sales rep for Ken Blanchard's company, and he has a huge sales team that he manages. And he said, I sat down with our sales team and said, all right, let's identify exactly what is our hit the glove. And before, it was like, I need to make 10 sales calls a day, for example. And he said, no, we need to change this. We need to make two, nail it. Let's define specifically what a quality sales call is, that after we get off that call, we know that we hit the glove. Let's focus on the quality. And so in the process of writing this book, he took his sales team through this process of hit the glove, defined it for his team, and they had 25% increase in sales. And he got this huge, in the midst of writing the book, he got this huge raise from a regional sales leader to the national sales leader. So there's a prime example of how he used the tool in the midst of reading the book of Hit the Glove. What's your Hit the Glove in business?
Mm-hmm. What when you were doing the research and then coming up with the stories with Judd that were going in the book, was there one that really surprised you that people would not really think of that was a great example of how a business individual or an athlete really manage crunch time well?
I wouldn't say there was any that was surprising as much as it was enlightening, Joe. You know, like I think there's a story in there, I think his name, Tom Watson, who was the CEO of IBM, and during the midst, I believe, of one of these like huge sales cycles, the person who was leading that to get that quota, like made a mistake or two and cost the company $10 million. If they would have made that quota, it was a $10 million loss or a potential gain. So Tom called him into the office. So as he walked in, he said, I guess you're either asking for my resignation or you're ready to fire me. He goes, are you kidding me? He goes, you just had a $10 million lesson that you learned. We invested $10 million for you to learn this lesson. He goes, I don't want to bring somebody else in to learn the same lesson and cost us another $10 million. He goes, this is great. This is not a setback. It's an opportunity for a comeback to understand how to deal with this more effectively. And then there was another one from a Navy SEAL. He was one of the top Navy SEALs of his team. And I'm trying to think how he called it. He said, our preparation for to go into a mission was so rigorous and so meticulous. Iron Ed was his nickname. And he said it was so meticulous that by the time we got to the mission, when we started the mission, we used to joke around. We called this monkey business because the mission was easy compared to the preparation. And I think there was just so many enlightening stories, you know, from you know, Judd and I doing research on other people, you know, who have gone down the path of dealing with pressure and shifting it, again, from a threat to an opportunity. That's why it's just so enlightening, because it identifies with everybody, from a student to someone in a career to a business. We don't have any stories in there, I don't believe, about doctors going into major surgeries. But since we wrote the book, we've actually talked to many of them. And, man, the fear, worry, and doubt for some of these doctors going into these major surgeries. I mean, not that the patients want to hear that. but you know, they deal with it. Everybody deals with it. And what was interesting, Morton Anderson, who just got inducted into the Hall of Fame, and
sure.
I heard someone asking the question, like, how did you prepare? How did you deal with this pressure? You're coming in, you got seconds left, you got a major kick. He goes, how did you deal with this pressure? He said, you know, I did meditation. He had a mindfulness practice. You know, he got into sports psychology, and he said, I really just focused on the moment. It was all about the process. And I basically, fear, worry, and doubt didn't come into my game because I knew I was so mentally and emotionally and physically prepared for this that it wasn't in the space of my mind. I was totally focused on exactly where I wanted to kick this ball.
The name of the book is Crunch Time. Our guest today on The Cusp Show is Rick Peterson, the co-author with Judd Hoekstra on this brand-new book that has come out, Forward by Billy Dean, great endorsement on the front cover by Michael Lewis. Rick, more importantly, in the last couple minutes before we let you go, how can people follow you on social media? And most importantly is, where can they get the book?
Well, the book, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. It's in airports across the country as well. You can find me on rickpetersoncoaching.com, and I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. And you know, you can find me on the boardwalk down at the beach in Jersey.
Rick's a Jersey guy right now. Lastly, the one question we like to ask people is, where do they get their information? So when you get up in the morning or when you're flipping through newspapers and magazines, who are some of the people that you follow that have helped you kind of grow your career?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I'm more, because I'm doing some media as well with MLB Network and SNY. You know, I more want to be, you know, relevant to what's happening in the baseball world. But also, you know, Harvard Review, Huffington Post. I mean, a lot of those, you know, places, Forbes, you know, where we've actually contributed some blogs ourselves. You know, they've asked us to contribute some. But I'm interested in, like, the Marshall Goldsmith. You know, he endorsed her book, and, you know, Simon Sinek. I mean, these are people that I've, that are, like, this is brand new into my world. You know, being in baseball for many years, I was, like, in a cave. And since this book, I've really, it's really been enlightening for me to be around so many other people and be involved. I did an audition for a TED Talk a couple weeks ago, and I'm waiting to hear back, you know, from that, which is exciting. The people I met there were just, like, you know, just such unique people that, you know, their minds are in such unique places to make a difference in people's lives. But I think the common thread, more than anything else, Joe, is that all these people I just mentioned, they share one major motivation. The quality of a person's life is to make a difference in someone else's in a positive way. And that's the motivation that all these people share.
Wow. Rick Peterson, pitching coach par excellence, philosopher, now doing a lot of things on the business side, trying to help people get along with his new book, Crunch Time. Thanks for joining us on The Cusp Show.
My pleasure, Joe. It was awesome.
Once again, you've been listening to the Columbia University Sports Podcast. I'm Joe Favorito, flying solo without my co-host Tom Richardson this week, and our guest has been Rick Peterson. Rick, it's a pleasure, and we hope that we'll catch up with you again down the line.
Awesome. Stay tuned. Looking forward to it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Cusp Show, the Columbia University Sports Podcast. I'm Tom Richardson, and my co-host is Joe Favorito. Our production assistant this week is Columbia student Reese Eisenman. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple's podcast app, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and other key platforms. You can also find it at blogtalkradio.com/The Cusp Show. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter at CU_SPS_sports. Also, you can find out more about our program, the Columbia University Sports Management Program, by going online at sps.columbia.edu/sports-management. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time.